This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Really, those of you with the Shalashudas, that we're very fortunate to have a very honored guest with us, Rabbi Hollander, who some of you might remember was with us, was a year ago, more than a year ago, 2 years ago, Rabbi Hollander from New York, who is fairly well known in this part of the world. He has been coming to South Africa on and off for many years for various different missions. And he is a very well known and outstanding Jewish orator. I say a Jewish orator because it's, when one talks about an orator, one normally thinks of the form rather than the content. Whereas Rabbi Hollander is an orator where there's amkus, where there's depth in what he says, and there's beauty in the way he says it. And with that in mind, as I mentioned earlier, pleaded with him to give the shiur this evening. For reasons which I don't fully understand, maybe he'll explain them later on, he refused. And first time anybody's refused to give them a Shabbos shiur. The first time anybody's been asked. But we did agree that I'll shorten the shiur a bit this evening, and we will get the benefits of both worlds. But Rabbi Hollander will give us a bit of a shiur immediately after we're finished. I would like to take the opportunity of asking Rabbi Hollander to address us.
Oh, Guten Morgen. And I wish to express my deep gratitude to your learned and eloquent rabbi for giving me the opportunity first to refuse and then to accept the invitation, at least in part. In his earlier comments at the Shalashudas, the rabbi said some very nice things about me. Among other things, he said he noted in the past, hope it is still true, that I was able to somehow hold the attention of the audience, and that in some other cases he noticed that some people were dozing off. So I just want to tell you, when he made that remark, I reminded myself of the story they tell about a rabbi who was delivering his sermon, and during the course of his talk, a man got up from his seat, you know, and very noticeably walked out, walking down the center aisle, out through the door. The rabbi was, of course, not very pleased, but he continued. And when he was finished, a woman came over to him and she said, Rabbi, I enjoyed your sermon very much. I also want to apologize for my husband who walked out. He really meant no offense, but he's just a man who walks in his sleep. The moral of the story is that in the light of the rabbis talk about etzemeyatzomai vosal bitsori, love and respect, your wife may not be your best attorney at all times. Anyway, I wish the rabbi had been with me in Cape Town last week where I gave a talk on the woman in Judaism, and then somebody asked me after the lecture, not publicly but privately, you would like me to give another lecture on a different topic. I said, what topic? He was a typical married man. I don't know exactly what was met the standards that the rabbi set here, I doubt it. He said, what topic are you so interested in? He said, I'd like to have a lecture on the topic, how to be happy though married. I said, I don't think that I am in a position to talk on a lecture topic that is worded the way you gave it. Anyway, I want to tell you, my friend, that I've been sitting here and learning a great deal as you, and I watched your rapt attention. Not only because what the rabbi said, after all, you know, you can have people talk, you can have a message, a speech recorded and listen to it, read a good book or essays, but when you know that the person who gives the message is also one who lives it, it is not just a mechanical performance, and unfortunately there are many instances where it is only that, in which case, however good the message in itself, it does not have the power to penetrate as when you know that the person who speaks from the heart, means that he means what he says. And I have, of course, heard a great deal about your rabbi. I heard him here about 2 years ago, not in this shul, and so I want to congratulate you on your wonderful new Beis HaMedrash and all the shiurim. But it is obvious that it is Dvorin HaYotzi Min HaLev, the words that go out of the heart, and therefore they are bound to penetrate not only to the mind. The mind is not enough. The mind is only intellectual. The rabbi spoke about emotion and the heart. And therefore I'm very glad to have been a member of the audience for the time that I had this evening of Metzori Shabbos. And I hope in Yitzhar Shem in the future to have a similar opportunity. I'd like to refer a little bit to the Seder of today, where the Torah refers, and this is Mishnah Torah, it is a more or less substantially, though not fully, a repetition of the previous four books of the Chumash. And the Torah refers, therefore, to the man, to the manna, to the heavenly bread by which the Jews lived during their 40 years in the desert. There are some very interesting halakhic questions, incidentally, about this, the manna, the food. I know since you are all learning shiurim, that you are interested in a little more than merely what you learned that there was such a food. The question has been asked, what kind of broche, if any, were the Jews required to make when they ate the manna? Was there a requirement to make a broche? After the Torah speaks about broches, certain broches that we have to make for the food that we eat, although not all brochas, in fact the majority are not min ha-Torah, but rabbonon, but the concept of brochas, of thanking God for whatever bounties we enjoy, is of course clearly established in the Torah. The question is, what kind of broche, if any, should they have made? Another question along the same lines is concerning the Tzimtzemes Amon, which has been put away, the jar of manna, which the Torah tells has been put away for the future, for the time of Bias HaMashiach, and if we eat that, what kind of broche will we have to make? And interesting, one of the authorities says that there is a broche already made for the food, for the manna. And the broche is HaMoitzi, about Limud HaTorah being the lechem, the bread, the staff of life. That same term is employed for the manna. But I only bring this up as a matter of interest for further consideration. What I really want to say about the manna is this, that the Mefarshim ask an interesting question. Tzedakah is a great mitzvah, as we all know. The rabbi spoke earlier today. There are certain mitzvahs that are confined to a particular time. Any other time, you cannot carry them out. But there are mitzvahs that are always applicable. And he gave the example of Limud HaTorah. I don't think I'm far out of line if I would say that tzedakah is such a mitzvah that's always applicable. Because tzedakah is not only a matter of giving money, it's a matter of giving shelter and food and a good word and a comfort and friendship. The Gemara says, HaMosein Teruto Le'oni Misboreich B'sheish Brochois Damafaisen Bitvorin is B'yud Ames Brochois. You give a poor man whatever he needs to eat, you have six brochas. But if you speak to him in such a way that he does not feel inferior, he does not feel rejected from society, after all, he grapples not only with the problem of physical sustenance, but to have a proper image of himself, to have some self-esteem. And when he has to come to someone else for support, that self-esteem can vanish completely, unless the donor, being a person who is guided by the Torah, goes out of his way to do it in such a manner and to say such words which will make him feel that his self-worth is not lost. So therefore the Mefarshim asked the question, since the Torah tells us that all the Jews lived on the man in the Midbar, in the desert, and that all had alike, in other words, nobody could have more than the next person, everyone was supplied in equal measure. So the Torah tells us in Parshas Mishalach. Therefore the question arises, how did the Jewish people in the Midbar carry out the mitzvah of tzedakah? But nobody needed any help. Imagine you live in a community of millionaires. Nobody needs any help. How did you become the mitzvah of tzedakah? But that was a situation in the Midpoint. Everyone was in equal economic standing. So that it means that the Torah brought about, the God brought about a situation where the Jews were deprived of the opportunity to be Mekayim, this great mitzvah of Tzedakah. And how could God do a thing like that to the people, to deprive them of such an essential mitzvah? And the answer, you're not watching the clock. You're sitting with your back to it. But I am watching it because I'm concerned about you getting out on time. Just so I want you to relax. The answer given is, because the Midrash says, there was something very special about the man. Not only did it satisfy your hunger, and the rabbi spoke here much about hunger and love, not that it only satisfy your hunger in the ordinary sense, but it had a certain quality that thus far all our inventiveness and technology has not yet even approached. What was that? If you wanted a particular taste, let's say you wanted to have a taste of the grace of steak, the manna was standard for everyone. But if your mind told you you want to have the flavor of steak, then you have it. But your mind could dictate the flavors that you would find in the manna. So whatever a person liked, whatever food he or she liked, all they have to do is think what food they would like, and that is the flavor which the manna produces. Now, you know, in Mitzrayim, the Jews were slaves. But some Jews had it better than most Jews. They had certain privileges. After all, many were guards that were given, the government, you know, told them to see to it that the Jews carry out their work assignments and so forth. There were also some who were never enslaved, as the Medrash tells us, during the whole time. And they lived a rather good life. So when they came to the Midbar, they knew the taste of various foods. I mentioned steaks, not my favorite food, any food that you can think of. They knew it. They remembered the flavor. And they were able, therefore, to enjoy in the manner the same kind of food that they had enjoyed in Mitzrayim. But what about the poor Jews who only ate dry bread and maybe some other very cheap food, ordinary food? Then they could not remember any flavor of any of the better food. So they could never feel the better food in the manna. So the tzedakah consisted of the following. That those who did enjoy very good food explained to the other Jews who had never had the good food what it feels like. And that was the tzedakah. I'm telling you something which the Medrash says. That was the tzedakah. Meaning that they did a good deed by enabling the people who had never sampled very good food to have it now in the Midbar. Why do I say all this, my friends? Because the flavor of true Yiddishkeit was all but lost in this community. Not that this is the only community that has had that situation, but I'm talking about this community. We are here now, and the rabbi referred to my many visits, and I came here, Baruch Hashem, years ago, when they first began to plant the seeds of prayer here. The people had lost the flavor of Yiddishkeit altogether. It became a matter of Friday night service and singing and so forth, you know, very cold and un-Jewish without any Torah content. And of course, it was nothing else but a thin veneer, and it certainly looked like it cannot possibly endure, and it would not have endured. But Baruch Hashem, there came certain people into this community, Rabbi Lapin's father, Rav Kosofsky, the family Brocha, and other people, a few people in the community, they reminded the other Jews of the true flavor of Yiddishkeit by not allowing them to forget what true Yiddishkeit really is. We got to the stage, Baruch Hashem, where various types of Torah institutions were founded. Even the synagogues have raised their spiritual level considerably as a result of this. And I'm not saying because Rabbi Lapin is sitting here, but you heard, everybody knows it already, not only in this country, and he set the standard here of the Yisod of Limud HaTorah, and thus bringing back the flavor. When I look at these pictures on the wall, they are all reminders of that flavor, which we almost lost. And Baruch Hashem, we are recapturing. These people who never gave up on the idea of reminding ourselves of the true flavor of Yiddishkeit. And this brings me to my final point. The rabbi spoke about, I'm trying to cull some of the things from the rabbi's excellent shiur tonight, spoke about the relation between God and man, between God and Jew. And obviously the role of God and the role of man are universes apart. Yet there is a point at which the Torah tells us, on the posuk letof kavoy, which the rabbi quoted here, how do you cleave to God? The distance is great. The species that term may use are vastly different. There's no possibility that etzem me'atomai bosor mitzvori doesn't exist. And yet it says to cleave. And the rabbi said, well-known minor, hadbe be'mitvesa shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. To emulate the ways of God, you cannot be a creator, you cannot be one who gives life or takes life away, but the Gemara enumerates Mahurahum, Atorahum, as God is merciful, you be merciful, and so on. And in that way, you are emulating God. And by emulating Him, and by seeing to it that these ideals of Rahum and Chanun and Zedek are implemented in daily life, you are cleaving unto God, because you are taking the Torah from the heaven and making sure that it's something very tangible on the earth. So therefore, there is a role in which God is supreme and in which He asks man to be very careful and sensitive. What is that role? The role of being a judge. To be a judge. God is the judge of the universe. But He also devoted a chapter in the Torah about 15 to 13 to tell Lecho, the Hoshe Orecho, to appoint judges everywhere. And in this, etc., one of the attributes of God described is that God does not take a bribe. He's the kind of a judge who does not take a bribe. Obviously, if you're going to emulate God, you have to be a judge who is honest, objective, and is not intoxicated by external trappings, and who judges a situation or a movement or a philosophy or an ideal by its true validity and not by how it is packaged. Because packaging is too much of an art in our time, and it has penetrated the area of Judaism no less than the area of commerce. So, if God does not take a bribe, then, obviously, the judge, Torah says, the sheikh had no sikho, ka sheikh had ya'ave ene ha'omin, it makes you blind, it makes you corrupt your words in tzadikim, etc. To this end, in the few minutes I have left, I'd like to bring to your attention a Gemara in Shavuos. I thank Moshe here, don't know him, for lending me the glasses through which I can see a little bit. And I want to say that this Gemara that I'm quoting came to my attention as a result of an excellent sefer, Leiv HaIvri, of the Mechaber of which is a great Goyen and Tzadik, Zecher Tzadik Livrocho, Harav Elia Lapian, a very close relative and uncle of Rabbi Lapin's father. I mean, it will take Rabbi Lapin to tell you about this great Torah giant who's no longer in our midst, but who did leave behind a great many writings, and only a little bit of which has been reproduced so that people like you and I can learn about it. In the first word, Gemara in Shavuos Lamed Aleph, where the Gemara says, how do we know that a judge before whom two people appear, one of them, Minayin Shnayim Shabo Ledin, Echot Lohush Smartutin, one is dressed in rags, the Echot Lohush Itzteles, Basmeo Mono, and the other litigant, two litigants, appear before a judge, one is dressed in rags, and one is dressed in a very expensive garment, which is worth a lot of money. How do we know that before listening to the arguments of the litigants, that the judge must see to it? The judge is the judge's responsibility to see to it that each of the litigants wears the same kind of garment. Not one looking very poor, and the one other one looking very wealthy, but you must see to it that they both wear substantially similar garments of similar value. How do we know that this is the requirement of a judge, as the Gemara? How do we know it from the Torah? And the answer is, the Torah says, Midvar Sheker Tirchot. Keep your distance from a falsehood, something that's false, from a lie. And since one is dressed rich and the other is dressed poor, and the judge might be influenced to give his decision in favor of the rich, or perhaps if he's a left-wing judge, he might give it in favor of the poor, even though the poor is not right. And he says the Torah warns against that. In Parshas Mishpatim it says, Gedol lo yiseh dar belivoy. If the poor man is wrong in a case before the judge cannot benefit the poor man by deliberately making him win the case against the rich man because the other man is rich. The judge wants to help the poor man. He has to help him on the basis of Milas Hesed or Tzedokah, but not through the corruption of justice. So how do we know that the judge must be said Mitzvah Sheker Tichot? Rav Lapian goes off in a wonderful explanation of why this is so, what visual perception can do to a judge. But I personally, the next 3-4 minutes, I would like to tell you that when I saw this Maimer, I had the following reaction to it, and I want to convey it to you as briefly as I can. So I said before, a judge must seek to judge objectively without prejudice. That is elementary. Unfortunately, just because it is elementary, it is not so in practical life. But I'm not talking only about a judge who is sitting with his robe and some other appurtenances in a form of courtroom. Every person, you and I, are judges all the time. We judge people, we judge ideas. It doesn't matter that we give a verdict, we don't give a verdict in terms of the law or possible punishment or reward, but that we are constantly engaged in judging, there's no question. And the Torah says, Shemoyah beinacheichem, ushmatetem tzedek. If you're going to give justice, then you better listen to both sides. Both sides, beinacheichem. Brothers, no differences, no kind of external fixing up or decoration or whatever should influence your judgment. I feel, my friends, that the Jewish people, I'll give just 2 or 3 examples, now we finished. The Jewish people especially have discovered with pain and suffering what it means when a judge, in order, here I'm not talking about a judge in a bench in a courtroom, but we have been judged by goyim throughout our diaspora, and in the present years, in the last few decades, they have judged us brutally, mercilessly, and I don't have to go into the horrible, agonizing details of what happened to our people at the hands of intellectual and learned, university-graduated scientists, philosophers, doctors, jurists, whatnot, from Germany and other countries, who pooled their energies and talents in order to build this huge diabolical death machine which devoured millions of our brethren. How did they do it? The rabbi said before, he spoke about that woman in California, about that she developed a certain admiration for her captors. He's very right. All the psychologists are right that in the concentration camps, because your life depended on your brutal captors, they got to a stage where they actually admired the people who were their potential murderers. Of course, it didn't affect anybody the same way. There were some exceptions, but by and large, and that explained why they could get them to do whatever they wanted. Now, not to resist. There was some resistance here and there because they got them into such a stage. But how did they get themselves to do this kind of brutal act of a systematic murder of fellow human beings? They looked like each other, they saw each other. They saw the Jew looked just like they did. And the answer is, what they did first was to dress the Jew in rags. That is to say, to describe him as subhuman, of pretend to deprive him of the protection of the laws, the Nuremberg laws, and then to give him numbers, take away their names. A person had a number, and to dress them literally in prison garb, and to treat them otherwise as animals or lower. And in that way, by putting upon them rags, and taking away from them their status as human beings, they didn't find it difficult anymore to commit mass murder. So the Gemara is saying to us, remember, by dressing somebody or some idea in rags, what you are doing is making it easier for you to demolish it, to destroy it, without rhyme or reason. But you have already made it easier because you're no longer facing a respectable object or person. What happened in Eretz Yisrael in the last few months between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? You all know the massacre in Lebanon. You all read about it. Perhaps never in history was there such a shocking uniform hypocrisy in the world toward the Jew by all nations, almost without exception. I believe your country, I think, may have been an exception towards the other countries. My country, unfortunately, was not an exception in this. A joy in the chorus in the condemnation of the Jew. And they all knew that condemnation, even the so-called indirect responsibility, was still made the Jews angels compared to the record of all the nations of the world. Why did they pour out that wrath? Because they cared about the Jews who were killed. And that it means nothing to them. They killed 100,000 before. Nobody said a word when they were killed by the PLO and others. But what they saw here was an opportunity to dress up the state of Israel and the Jewish people in rags and say to them, you are no better than we are. You are murderers. You can make a Holocaust too. But there's no comparison whatsoever. But in order to somehow lessen the guilt, they have some guilt that they're still bearing. The goyim, as bad as they are, something bothers them deeply. And here they're able to say, and they said it in the press, you can read it. You're no better than we are. You do the same thing. It's a case of dressing up in rags and thereby enabling them to do all the evil that they wanted to do, and Baruch Hashem, they did not succeed in doing. The last point I will make on this is internal in Jewish life. In the last 7-8 decades in our history, maybe a little more, but it's still prevalent now, there has been an assault from within on Torah Judaism. After all, going back 80, 90 years ago, Torah Judaism was the only Judaism that was recognized to be Judaism. Then it began an assault upon it. How? Not by actually, as one would expect, to argue effectively against any teaching of the Torah, which they would not have been successful had they followed the rules of judging honestly. What did they do? They dressed up Torah Judaism in rags. It was obsolete. It did not fit the modern times. It will drive away the young people. It is inconsiderate. It doesn't have any compassion. It doesn't care about these people and that people. All kinds of fraudulent, false kind of stains and accusations against Torah Judaism in order to get it to the stage where you can take away its image and discredit it. And this is why we have reached a stage, I cannot talk more at length, a mission to the rabbi, something on the way here in Israel. This situation now is developing, and only yesterday I heard a reform minister who originally comes from South Africa, lives in Israel, came back yesterday to lecture, and I happened to hear him just because I walked into a certain building where he was giving a lecture, and I heard the assault, you know, upon the so-called ultra-Orthodox, those who are trying to bring Israel back into the Dark Ages. But what else is the Torah? The Dark Ages. They are the ones who brought the illumination. What they did, however, the clever thing was they dressed up the Torah in rags to get even some Orthodox Jews, you know, on the borderline to be influenced by it. And therefore the judgment is false. And we have to be careful not to allow the packaging to bring about any wrong kind of conclusion. I want to conclude out with these words. The Gemara says, Kol Dayon Shedon Din Emes La Mitoi Nase Shutef La Kodesh Baruch Hu B'Masei Bereshis. Any judge, and we already said before that every individual is a judge. They are told in Eskaberchov, we're all judges. But every judge who judges honestly, says the Gemara, becomes a partner to God in the creation of the world. Why? Because the continuity of the world depends on the restoration of justice, of Shemoya Bein Achichem Ushmatetem Tzedek, where both ideas, this idea and the opposing idea, appear equally dressed, not with a prejudice. Only then can there be a proper decision without bribery, and only then will we arrive at the Amitosoi Sheldin, in keeping with the title we give to our Torah, Ashenosa Lonu Toiras Emes. He gave us a Torah of truth. Thank you.